This is the Relic Radio Show, old-time radio entertainment still standing the test of time, from RelicRadio.com. This is the Relic Radio Show. Thanks for joining me again this Tuesday. We'll hear first this week from The Diary of Fate, an episode titled The Marvin Thomas Entry from June 8, 1948. Then it's Incredible But True with Requiem. Finish off with Zero Hour and Death is the Puppeteer, an episode from May 24th, 1974.
The Diary of Fate.
Fate plays no favorites. It could happen to you.
Book 83. Page 947.
In the Diary of Fate.
Yes, here it is. The name, Marvin Thomas. Occupation, secretary. Yes, Marvin, as a male secretary, you have been successful. Your pay is more than twice what other men in similar positions receive. But you have earned it, haven't you, Marvin? And what you have gained in money, you have lost in self-respect. For although you and your employer are of equal age and intelligence, his endless humiliating domination has made you so intimidated and obsequious that he ruled you completely. And now, I, fate, intervene. And because of a little thing, you will be forced to a decision. A decision for evil. As this man moves through life, you who listen may think me unfair. But fate is not cruel, not unmindful of mortal rights. In a moment, it will be time for another entry under the name Marvin Thomas. When I have written, I will read from his record in The Diary of Fate. I hope you'll understand. Mortal is granted foresight to perceive the future. And now I, fate, look ahead at a single portentous instant to a dark pitching deck of an ocean liner far out at sea.
What's that? Thomas, are you drunk? What are you doing? Put that iron bar down. Thomas, you're out of your mind. Don't.
I'm not out of my mind, Mr. Fielding. I'm going to be rid of you.
Thomas,
no. Good.
Don't. Thomas!
No mortal has the ability to say what even the next hour will bring. For the consequences of little things are beyond reckoning. Yes, the countless trifling incidents of everyday life are the tools with which I, fate, mold the shape of destiny. I have no choice. But you, Marvin, were not aware of this as you sat in the lavish house overlooking Honolulu and nervously sipped a drink. Your employer, the very wealthy recluse, Mr. Gregory Fielding, plagued by arthritis and addicted to cynicism, was talking about you in the presence of a beautiful woman, Nina Carroll.
And what's more, Thomas, it's all your fault.
I'm sorry, Mr. Fielding,
You're really not stupid, Thomas. You're merely spineless. I told you to put a sting in that letter to Barnes. If you'd done that properly, he wouldn't have dared delay the shipment. Now it'll be at least 2 weeks late.
Well, what does it matter after all? The copra can't spoil, can it?
No, Nina, but the market can. And that lily-livered, namby-pamby attitude Thomas has will cost me several thousand dollars. Right, Thomas?
Yes, sir, I'm afraid that's right.
You're so timid, a pat on the wrist is your idea of severity. Now, listen to me, Thomas. I told you to be tough in that letter to Barnes, and I meant put the fear of the devil in him. Do you hear me?
Gregory, your drink.
Oh, blessed it.
Here's my napkin, sir. Oh,
sticky stuff. I've got it all over my hand. Out of the way, Thomas. I'll have to go wash it off. Excuse me, Nina.
Well, what are you staring at, Thomas?
Oh, I... Sorry, Miss Carroll, Well, thanks for taking my side.
No, taking your side? Don't be ridiculous. What's the matter? Is my lipstick on upside down? You're still staring.
Sorry, I didn't mean... That is...
Oh, good heavens, don't be ashamed. A woman thrives on being stared at.
Miss Carroll, Nina, you're so beautiful.
Careful, Thomas. You'll burn your fingers.
Nina.
Yes, Gregory?
Run along now, will you?
Oh, but I thought we'd have the evening together.
I'm sorry, but Thomas has made such a mess of things, I'll have to get to work. And tell Clint to bring the car around, Thomas. He's to drive Miss Carroll home.
It's Clint's night off. He's gone, Mr. Fielding. Shall I call a cab?
Oh, no. You may as well drive yourself. You'll be no help to me here.
Very well, sir. I'll get a car.
Yes, Thomas. A little thing. A spilled drink. And now you were driving Nina home. And although she rode in the back seat, the nearness of her, combined with the hatred you held for Mr. Fielding, made you bold and reckless.
Nina, Nina, you yourself told me not to be ashamed, and I'm not. You are beautiful. I'm in love with you.
Why, Tommy, are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding. We're away from the house now. Won't you call me Marvin?
What would Gregory say about this?
I don't care. I despise him. He's a mean, sickly beast. How can you possibly be in love with him?
What makes you think I am? Why are we stopping?
You're not in love with Mr. Fielding. I thought maybe you'd like to ride up here in the front seat with me.
Oh, so you're a man and not a mouse after all. No, Thomas, I think not. I'll ride back here. You're just doing this to get even with Gregory.
That's not true. Nina, I love you.
This has gone far enough. The go sign in my life is the dollar sign. You haven't got it, and I don't think you have the nerve to ever get it. So start driving, Thomas.
All right. But you'll see. I'm going to change things. Do you hear? I've put up with his insults and his high-handed ways long enough. For 12 years, I've been humiliated. Well, now I'm going to do something about it. You just wait and see.
An idea once planted and nourished with sufficient incentive often takes root and grows. That is why the next morning, as you worked with your employer, the things he said formed a strange pattern in your mind.
Thomas, I've decided to go to Australia myself.
Australia? On the Copac deal? But may I ask, why, sir?
I need a vacation. Besides, I want to see the Copac brothers squirm. I've arranged to have them pay the entire amount in cash. $100,000. It's liable to break them.
I see, sir.
It should be interesting to watch them pay a fortune to a man they've never seen, whom they know only as a letterhead powerful enough to crush him. Besides, I've never been to Australia.
Are you flying, sir?
No, I want to sail. You're coming with me, so make all the necessary arrangements for next Wednesday.
Yes, sir.
And, by the way, call Dr. Komodo. Tell him my arthritis is bad again. I want a treatment this afternoon at 3. And while he's here, you may as well have him arrange for a doctor in Sydney to continue the treatment. Oh, and Thomas.
Yes, sir.
Please, don't bungle that point. Stress the fact that I must have them on time once a week. Understand?
Yes, Mr. Fielding.
Your idle threat to change things was no longer idle, Marvin Thomas. Now it had begun to grow. An idea was taking form. And as you went about the petty routine of the day, the words of your employer echoed in your mind.
They will pay the entire amount in cash. $100,000. Pay a fortune to a man they've never seen. They know him only as a letterhead. Never been to Australia. $100,000. Cash.
Oh, hello, Dr. Komodo. Come in.
Well, thank you, Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Fielding is going to make a trip to Sydney.
Oh?
He'd like you to arrange with the doctor there to continue the treatment for his arthritis. Can you do it?
Oh, yes, I can do it.
And stress the importance that the treatment be on time.
Oh.
Mr. Fielding made a particular point of that. You're smiling. Is something wrong?
No, no, I will take care of it.
It isn't really important, is it? That's why you're amused.
Well, it is not for me to say. Modern medicine is a peculiar combination of drugs and psychology.
I thought so. You're pretty sly, Doctor. Getting a fat fee each week for 12 years for your psychology.
Oh, do not misunderstand me, Mr. Thomas. The psychology is important, but the drugs, the injection and the tablet, they serve a most definite purpose.
Yes, Marlin. Another item on your list was checked off. Another step taken down a path new and strange to you. A desperate, evil path. On the ruse of delivering a package, you went to Nina Carroll's cottage.
Thomas, what are you doing here?
I must talk to you, Nina. It's tremendously important to me. It's about the other night when I drove you home.
I told you that had gone far enough.
But I'm in love with you. I must know how you feel about me.
Now, see here, Marvin. Well, I told you already. As a person, I like you very much. But there are other things in the world I like more. Things that money can buy. And under the circumstances, I can't afford...
Wait. If I had money, lots of money, things would be different, wouldn't they?
Decidedly different, Marvin.
That's what I wanted to hear you say. Hello. Pinson Steamship Line? Yes. I'd like to know what time the Benjamin B sails for Sydney. At 9:30 p.m. from Pier 13. I see. I want to make a reservation. I want to reserve a cabin on Wednesday, first class. Mr. Gregory Fielding. No, no one else. Mr. Fielding is traveling alone.
Yes. As far as the steamship company would know, Mr. Fielding was traveling alone. But that was not the truth. For you had every intention of being aboard the Benjamin B, too, when she sailed. Only you and I, Fate, knew that. Knew the full implication of that untruth. And now, there was no turning back. You would follow the road you had chosen to its inevitable end. In a moment, it will be time for another entry in the Diary of Fate. Was simple but daring. And as the day of departure approached, your confidence mounted. No one knew your employer's habits as intimately and completely as you. You knew them so well that, given the opportunity, you could actually become Gregory Fielding. And it was your intention to give yourself that opportunity. On Wednesday evening, you boarded the ship to arrange the final details for Mr. Fielding. And then you phoned him from the dock.
Mr. Fielding, this is Thomas.
Is everything in order in my cabin?
Yes, I just checked it myself. It's a very nice cabin, sir. Number A-12.
Good. I'll arrive at 9:25. You stay there and meet me at the gangplank.
Very well, sir. Would you like me to order a late supper for you?
No, don't bother, but I'll want all my meals served in the stateroom. You've taken care of that?
I've taken care of everything, Mr. Fielding. Everything. Mr. Fielding. Mr. Fielding.
Oh, there you are, Thomas. I've been looking all over for you. Here, take this bag. These stupid crowd, stuffy officials. Where's my stateroom?
This way, sir. Right down this passageway to the left.
Lead the way, Thomas. I want to get out of this idiotic mob.
We're underway, sir.
Thank heaven for that. Now maybe that mob out there will quiet down.
If I may make a suggestion, Mr. Fielding, the deck will be cool soon. You might enjoy the open air if your room stays hot.
Good idea. But I'll wait until that giddy crowd has gone to bed. I can't stand them.
I know. I have had a chair placed for you on the boat deck. It will be secluded and private there.
Oh, well, fine. Thank you, Thomas.
Not at all, sir. Now, if you'll excuse me.
Yes, Marvin. Now everything was ready. All that remained was the deed itself. But you expected no difficulty there. And so you walked the decks and mingled with the passengers, waiting until they had retired. For only then could you strike. But at that moment, Thomas, I, fate, again moved in your life. In cabin A-12... Mr. Fielding was unpacking a briefcase, and a picture fell to the floor. He picked it up, looked at it, and on an idle whim, reached for the telephone.
Hello? This is Mr. Fielding in A-12. I want to send a radiogram to Miss Nina Carroll, 420 Kalani Drive, Honolulu. Message, Nina, take plane for Sydney. Meet me in my office at 5 p.m., on the 14th. Sign it, Gregory.
Yes, Marvin. Unknown to you, the ship's radio was flashing a message to Nina. Now you were pleased because you knew the other passengers would go below all the sooner. And you were right. The time had come. You pulled a heavy iron stanchion from its bracket and climbed to the boat deck. Then you stood in the shadows and watched Gregory Fielding as he shifted uncomfortably in the deck chair.
Who's there?
It's only I, sir. Thomas.
Well, why are you lurking in those shadows like a shy schoolboy? You should be in bed at this hour.
I was restless. The ocean always makes me feel that way.
Yes, there's power in the ocean. You can feel it, Thomas, but you'll never understand it, I'm afraid.
Why do you say that?
You have no concept of power, that's why. You're weak and indecisive.
I think you're wrong, Mr. Fielding.
Don't be silly. Here we are, two men of the same age and equal intelligence. Yet look at the difference. You can't make a decision and act on it, but I can. That's the difference, Thomas.
There's no difference.
What's that? Oh, you're talking like a fool.
There's no difference. The people who don't know us will fail to see any difference.
Thomas, are you drunk? What are you doing? Put that iron bar down. Thomas, you're out of your mind. Don't.
I'm not out of my mind. I'm going to get rid of you.
Thomas, for good. No, don't. Thomas!
Yes, Marvin, the last earthly sound of Gregory Fielding was swallowed up by wind and water, and you felt you were safe. free and rich. For the rest of the voyage, you rehearsed your new role until it was perfect. At last, when the ship docked at Sydney, you were anticipating the business meeting of the Colpack brothers with the same malicious delight Mr. Fielding would have as you went at once to the branch offices of the firm.
So, you're Mr. Birch, our Sydney branch. Well, Mr. Birch, I'll require some minor accommodations during my stay here. I want a private office and a private wire. Your best secretary at my disposal exclusively. Bring out the monthly report. I'll look them over first. That's right, Mr. Birch. The Colpack brothers already have been notified as to the terms of the payment. Have them here in my office at 8 this evening. I'll handle the whole thing myself.
Yes, Marvin. In a matter of hours, the transaction would be completed. You were sure that nothing could stop you now. But then, another little thing happened. And two unrelated elements in your borrowed life were brought into close conjunction.
Yes? What is it?
I'm sorry to bother you, Mr. Fielding, but there's a gentleman here. A Dr. Cooper.
Cooper? I don't know any Dr. Cooper. What does he want?
He says he has orders from a Dr. Komodo in Honolulu.
Oh, of course. Send him in, Miss O'Brien.
Yes, Mr. Fielding.
Good afternoon, Mr. Fielding. I'm Dr. Cooper.
Well, how do you do, Doctor?
Dr. Komodo wrote to me about you. I've brought all the necessary items with me for your treatment.
Oh, well, Doctor, as a matter of fact, I'm very busy just now. I wonder, would you mind terribly coming to my hotel later in this evening?
Well, no, certainly not, sir. But Dr. Komodo was so emphatic regarding the time that I...
Yes, I know, but as it happens, I'm too busy to take it at the moment. I'll see you, say, at 9:30. Yes?
I'm sorry, sir. There's a lady here to see you. A Miss Carroll. Nina Carroll.
Nina? Here? Oh, doctor. Just a moment. Miss O'Brien, where is the lady now?
Waiting in the foyer, sir.
I see. Tell Miss Carroll I'm with my doctor. I'm taking a treatment. I won't be able to see her. She's to go back to her hotel and wait until I call. And Miss O'Brien, until the Colpack brothers arrive, I am not to be disturbed under any circumstances. Is that clear?
Yes, Mr. Fielding.
I've changed my mind, Doctor. I'll take that treatment.
Fine, sir. Fine, sir. Now remove your shirt, please. You know, these tablets here are exactly the same as you've been getting in Honolulu. Dr. Komodo sent me complete, detailed instructions. Everything will be just as he would have given.
Fine, fine. Been taking these treatments for over 12 years, you know. Couldn't get along without them.
Komodo and I were students together years ago. I have great faith in him. He's an excellent physician.
Yes.
Sorry, sir, sorry. Just a moment now. There you are. Injection always stings a little, doesn't it?
Yes, but it does the work. Only thing that gives me any relief.
Yes, I know. I'll leave my card with you, Mr. Fielding, in case you want to reach me before next time.
Hey. Fine. Thank you, Doctor. And good day.
Good day.
Yes, Marvin. Little things often become unbelievably important. Had the doctor not been in your office when Nina arrived, your whole elaborate plan might have collapsed. But now you could meet her later and explain it all where her shocked surprise would not matter. All that was left now was the business meeting with the Colpack brothers. You sat at the table and, one by one, went through the steps of the transaction. The Colpacks were afraid of you, and you gave them no reason to doubt your identity. At last, you lifted the fortune in your hand.
$100,000. Very well, gentlemen. The amount is correct. Our business is concluded. Thank you, and good night.
Yes, Marvin Thomas.
It was done. You were rich and free. But although the laws of nations differ, and the philosophies of peoples vary, there remains one inescapable constant in the universe. The irrevocable law of justice. And you who listen, lest you think fate a conspirator and evil, heed well this final entry. For in a few moments, I will write for the last time in the record of Marvin Thomas. And when I have written, I will read from the Diary of Fate. Thomas, as you carefully placed the fortune in your pocket, you were sure you now had everything you had ever wanted. You attributed the spinning in your head and the weakness in your knees to the strain of the during masquerade. But your face became drenched with cold perspiration, and the short walk from the elevator to your room left you breathless. You stumbled inside and locked the door. Everything was spinning dizzily now, and the floor seemed to roll beneath your feet. Now you stumbled to the telephone to call Dr. Cooper.
This is Dr. Cooper.
Doctor, Mr. Fielding, something's wrong. I'm sick. I can't breathe. I've got a cold sweat. Those pills... The tablets you gave me, what were they?
Why, they're the same thing you've been taking right along, sir. They're quite harmless, I assure you.
But the injection, what about it?
Oh, it shouldn't bother you, Mr. Fielding. I followed Dr. Komodo's instructions to the letter. It was given in strict accordance with the cumulative immunity you've developed over 12 years.
Immunity? Doctor, what would happen if a man with no immunity... received that injection.
It's an autogenous vaccine, harmless to you because you gradually built up resistance to it. Without the cumulative immunity, that dose I gave you would result in certain death within 5 hours.
Yeah. Within 5 hours?
And now I close the book. Marvin Thomas is dead. Another entry has been duly noted on the pages of eternity, and justice has been served. In the case of Marvin Thomas, as in the cases of all mortals, I, fate, am but the instrument of a plan. And the little things that happen, unnoticed, apparently trivial, are the tools with which I work. A spilled drink set a man on the path of murder. And a casual remark led him to his own death. Ponder well the moral, you who listen, and remember, there is a page for you in...
The Diary of Fate. Produced by Larry Finley, Diary of Fate is a Finley transcription. Brought to you from Hollywood.
To those who appreciate music but do not create it, the whole process of musical composition is a major mystery, and usually the artist himself cannot explain it. But there is on record the story of one man, the great Frenchman Charles Camille Saussaz, who knew that death itself had produced his Requiem.
In 1871, Saussaz was known merely as a brilliant young virtuoso. He held the post of organist at the Madeleine in Paris. On a certain day in January of that year, when the Franco-Prussian War was drawing to a close, he applied for a brief leave of absence so that he might meet his old friend Henri Renault in a town somewhere near the front lines. Renault had written him that he would be spending his day's furlough there, but when Saint-Saëns arrived, the commanding officer to whom he applied for information told him,
"I am sorry, monsieur. The company to which your friend is attached has not yet returned from the front. If you will do me the honor of having dinner with me or whatever, Reynolds' loss will be my gain."
So the composer, deeply disappointed though he was, sat down at a table in the commanding officer's quarters. And the two men dined together. The dandelion wine was powerful, if not tasty, and before long, Saint-Saëns had forgotten his disappointment and was enjoying himself thoroughly. Yes, Camille Saint-Saëns was in excellent spirits. And then suddenly, he stopped laughing. The smile was gone from his face. And then, a bewildered frown furrowed his brow.
"How strange! How very strange!
Monsieur, what is it? Are you ill?"
"I heard music."
"Music?"
"In my mind, of course. While I was laughing, it came very suddenly. Chords that I've never heard before. Usually I must labor to find a theme. This one came almost as if it was someone else who created it."
"A theme for a symphony, perhaps?"
"No, not a symphony. It is too sad for that. They are the most mournful chords I have ever heard. They speak only of death. If I use them at all, it must be for a requiem."
Saint-Saëns returned to Paris that same evening without having seen Henri Renault. It was on the following afternoon that the commanding officer in the little town sat down reluctantly to pen a letter to his recent dinner guest.
"I must hasten to pass on to you this sad news. Yesterday, even as we sat together at dinner, your dear friend Henri Renault was killed by an enemy bullet."
Yes, Renault's death had occurred at precisely the same moment as Saint-Saëns heard the tragic chords. And the Greek composer himself was profoundly impressed by the fact. It is a matter of fact that his immortal requiem came into being at the very instant that his dearest friend met his death on the battlefield. And this is a fact. Incredible, but true.
Serling. You're listening to The Zero Hour. Rest your eyes. Exercise your imagination. Today, Glenn Hall Taylor's story of murder and fear. Death is the puppeteer. Starring Lyle Wagoner. In a Mutual Broadcasting System presentation of The Zero Hour.
Brought to you by the Ford Motor Company, Beechnut Chewing Tobacco, Shenley Industries, Matus Wine, and Kodak. This is The Zero Hour on Mutual Radio.
Mr. Know-it-all here, the man who knows everything about everything.
What baseball record does Greg Bruno hold?
An original copy of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Hello, Mr. Know-it-all.
Who made up Abraham Lincoln's cabinet?
Carl Schwab in Walnut. Hello, Mr. Know-it-all.
Can you tell me where the great planes are located?
At the great airports, of course. Hello, Mr. Know-it-all.
What compact car offers two gas stingy engines, a six-cylinder, and the smallest displacement V8 made by a major American manufacturer?
That's
Ford Maverick, Mr. Know-it-all.
Well, I didn't know that.
And did you know that the five-passenger Maverick has more rear seat leg room than either Nova or Valiant?
Well, I didn't know that either.
Well, now that you know, stop in at your local Ford dealer.
Over the last 5 years, Ford dealers have sold more small cars, cars with wheelbases of less than 112 inches, than any other single group of dealers in America. Come see your local Ford dealer. He's Small Car Headquarters.
Hello, this is the new Mr. Know-it-all.
Since the time of the ancient Greek theater with its processions and its choruses, man has been fascinated with seeing and hearing his dreams, his frustrations, and his revels reenacted upon the stage. In the theater, he may laugh at high comedy or tremble at stark tragedy. And when tragedy strikes where there is comedy, it is most telling. As in the story you're about to hear. But our drama occurs not on stage, but backstage. In a theater where a revival of vaudeville is being held. May Granby of the comedy team of Granby and Granby emerges from a dressing room, descends a spiral iron staircase, and crosses to the stage door.
Hey, where are you going, May?
Out.
But you're on in 15 minutes.
Not me. Let me out of here.
Hey, wait a minute. Cool it. Now, what's the problem?
I'm through. I've had it. I'm turning in my grief.
Look, baby, you can't walk out like this. It ain't professional.
Don't give me that show must go on garbage.
Does Al know you're leaving?
I don't care whether that bum knows or wants to stop.
Now, wait. Hey, Pop.
Right here, Mr. Wakefield.
Go up down Granby's dressing room. Ask him to come down here, will you?
Oh, okay.
Now, let's try to settle this thing. Now, what's the beef this time?
The beef this time and all the time is that I just can't stand working with him.
But he's your husband.
He's also a comic. Only ain't funny. He says I sing off key. He says I step on his laughs.
Comics are like that. You can't walk out on him just because he gets a fight or a performance or two.
Ah, that ain't why I'm walking out. He's on a new kick now. He thinks I'm on the make for Tom Kent, that tenor in the Flash Act. What would I want with a tenor? I like a guy with...
Have you given Al any reason to be jealous?
No. Kent told me I had real talent, and I told him I thought he was a real doll to say so. Al heard only the real doll part and blew a stack. Now he thinks we've got a thing going between us.
The whole fight was over that?
Yeah. But it was one fight too many. And if you think I'm going to let any black-faced comic, even if he is my husband...
Excuse me, Mr. Wakefield. Mr. Granby can't come down.
Why not?
He's dead.
Oh, but... Not... Al...
You're the manager of this theater?
That's right. I'm Wally Wickfield.
I'm from Homicide, Dan McBride. Have you touched anything in this dressing room since the body was discovered?
Not a thing. I found Mr. Granby just like that.
The reason he's in blackface, Lieutenant, is that he and his wife are due to go on. Incidentally, I went on stage and told the audience the remainder of the performance was canceled due to a death in the cast.
Good. I mean, what's the story on this man, Granby?
He was a relic from the old days of vaudeville. After all, burnt court comics aren't exactly the new generation's idea of hip comedy.
Did he work by himself?
No, his wife played straight for him.
She here?
Downstairs. Oh, by the way, she hasn't seen the body yet. We thought we'd better get things cleaned up a bit first.
Yeah, and you discovered the body, right?
Yes, sir, Mr. Wakefield. We were all downstairs backstage. Asked me to come up here and send Al down to him and May.
May?
Yeah, that's Mrs. Granby. When I came up, the dressing room door was closed. I knocked. When I got no answer, I opened the door and peeked in on account of I'd seen Al in here just a few minutes before.
Mm-hmm. And he was lying just as he is now?
Yes, sir.
Did you ever see that knife before?
Many times. It's been in the prop room for years.
That'd be where the stage properties or supplies and other paraphernalia kept?
Right.
Yeah. Any idea who might have done this?
No, sir.
Did you hear any arguments, quarreling or anything before the stabbing?
No.
Yeah. Any strangers come in or go out your stage door?
No.
Okay. It'll be all for now, but we may want to talk to you again, so don't leave the theater.
Why should I leave? I work here all night.
Mr. Wakefield, as I recall, you said you hadn't seen the body until I arrived.
Right. After I'd insisted Mrs. Granby not come up here, I stayed with her trying to calm her down.
When did you see him last?
During the supper show.
How long have you known him?
Quite a few years, on and off. I used to manage a vaudeville house. I booked the act several times.
Mm-hmm. How'd you get along with him?
Oh, fine. Hey, look, you don't think I have
I any... was just asking a question.
We got along fine, very friendly.
Mm-hmm. Had he had any trouble, arguments or such, with any of the people who were working here?
One, his wife.
Oh? What sort of trouble?
Oh, the usual man and wife spats, professional jealousies popping up and so on. He had a big go-round only today, as a matter of fact. I caught her just as she was walking out of the show.
Did she say what made her decide to leave?
Said Al gave her a bad time, suspicious that she was getting involved with Tom Kent.
Who's Tom Kent?
A singer. Works in the Flash Act on the bill.
Was she involved?
Well, she told me she wasn't. And as far as I know, she was always loyal to Al.
And I was always loyal to Al. You gotta believe me.
I'll try. Mrs. Granby, do you think you're up to looking at your husband's body now?
As up to it as I'll ever be, I guess.
What is it?
That body. That's not my husband.
It isn't?
No. Take that wig off him.
A wig, huh?
Mm-hmm.
There we are.
You see? That guy's got blonde hair. That's Tom Kent.
But since rosé is any kind of wine you want it to be, it's a picnic wine, a candlelight wine, just try some.
Matus is a rosé wine imported from the old world to go with everything good. It has a light, easy-to-like taste, so it makes good food even better. Good people, friendlier. In good times, well, just try some and see. Imported by Draper's Ashby & Company, New York, New York. To be any kind of wine you want it to be.
Granby didn't leave the theater?
Sure as I'm standing here. Not by the stage door, anyway.
Did you get anything from the other ushers or doormen, Mr. Wakefield?
Checked them all. None of them saw Al Granby leave by any of the exits.
Hello. Communications? Lieutenant McBride here. I want you to put out a pickup on Al Granby. Suspicion of murder. About 5'10", auburn hair, balding in front. Now, give me the laboratory, please. This is Lieutenant McBride. I need a lab man over here at the Henry Irving Theater. Yeah. And have him bring a photographer along, too. Get him over here on the double. Hiya, Pat. You made good time. The body's right there. You know the angles I need. Shoot them.
Right, Dan.
Oh, and Dave, dust the knife handle for prints. And maybe the doorknob and the dressing table.
Yeah, I'll get everything I can.
While I was waiting for you guys, I figured out something. I think the blackface makeup and the wig and the dressing gown were put on this man after he was killed. Take a look at the hole in the fabric, right around the knife.
Yeah, you're right. The knife didn't make that hole. It was cut or torn so the dressing gown could be slipped over the knife handle.
Right. And I think he died immediately. There's only one blotch of blood here. Obviously, he didn't move around after the stabbing. Now then, come over here to the other side of the room. Now, this is a puzzler. There's bloodstains on the floor and on the windowsill. I'd say this is how Granby got out. He was bleeding, too.
Well, then he must have been wounded while attacking the dead man.
Not likely. The dead man was stabbed from behind, and there's no sign of a struggle.
Yeah, well, I suppose it could be that...
Help!
Well, what was that?
Well, it sounds like the old doorman. Come on. Now, watch it, Dave. These stairs are tricky, and the whole stage is dark.
Oh, here, I got my flashlight.
Oh, yeah, that's better.
Help someone!
It is the doorman. I can't see you, Pop. Are you okay? Dave, shine your light over there towards the stage door.
Hey, look. There he is, stretched out on the floor.
Take it easy, old-timer. Don't move. Now, tell me, what happened?
He hit me on the head, got away.
Who, Pop, who?
Al Granby.
Who's there?
It's me, McBride.
Oh.
What's the idea of sneaking out here to the box office? I gave explicit orders no one was to leave the green room.
Well, I had business to attend to. We canceled a show tonight. That means a lot of refunds. I wanted to go over the receipts.
Why didn't you ask permission?
Well, I did. The cop you stationed at the green room said it's okay.
You should have asked my permission.
I'm sorry.
How'd you get out here? Through the stage door?
No, I came out to one of the fire exits at the side of the theater.
Were the lights on backstage when you left?
Yeah. Why?
We found the lights turned out and Pop was slugged. Whoever clobbered him must have gotten out the stage door into the alley. You were seen in the alley.
The fire exit's open on the alley. I never touched the old boy. Look, if I was planning to take it on the lam, I wouldn't be here now, would I?
You might be. You could be out here emptying the till while looking for a chance to split.
Well, you could get laughs on that routine.
Okay, I'll give you a straight line. What about the fight you had with the tenor, Tom Kent, the dead man?
Who told you that?
One of the stagehands. Now, come on. Lock up your cash and get back to the green room.
Oh, hi, Dave.
Hi.
Are you about through? I've got all the pictures we need.
Yeah, I think I'm about done. The morgue's taking the body.
Yeah, Dan okayed it.
Yeah, well, where is he now?
Oh, he decided to investigate further. You know, the blood over there on the windowsill.
Oh, so that's why the window's open. Oh, what'd he do, get down the fire escape?
Yeah, he's on his way back up now.
It's hard to believe. When I was a rookie in uniform, I chased a guy up a fire escape to a third-story balcony. That was before I developed a balcony of my own. Well, at least the climb down and back was worth it. Even if I did get half the dust on the fire escape all over my nice new double knit.
Here, let me help you brush it off.
Oh, no, thanks. I can manage. By the way, I've concluded that Al Granby didn't slug the old doorman.
So what now?
I'm releasing all the suspects.
Hey, you found the murderer?
Not yet, but I have a hunch who it is. Let's go downstairs.
More questions, Lieutenant?
Not for now, Mrs. Granby.
Does that go for me also?
Yep, you're on your own. And you can buzz off too, Pop.
These are my working hours. I stay.
Do what you like. Right now, I'm going to concentrate on finding Al Granby.
If you find him, please call me. I gotta know what's happened to him.
I'll let you know, Mrs. Granby. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, Lieutenant. I'll be around if you need me.
Thanks a lot. Hey, you two stick with me.
Okay. Hey, where are we going? Back downstairs into the theater. Into the theater?
But this time, we're going by way of a fire escape.
The mind teach a man what he can and he can't. No mind makes exceptions for you. You learn to stay on your guard, looking after your part. You learn beach nuts that are back of you. Like my daddy told, when you go at the cold, you're not down there to take in the view. You keep respect for the mind, concentrate all the time. Of course, beech nuts for the back of you chew. What makes beech nuts such a traditional favorite? It's cause beech nut just keeps on getting better. It's a moister, more satisfying chew. Next time you're buying chewing tobacco, try beech nut. You won't be disappointed. Then when your shift's done, you come back to the sun. You and the boys hoist a few. It ain't such a bad life. She ain't such a bad wife. You got your beech nut tobacco to chew.
Thank you.
how high two stories seems when you're outside a building.
Don't worry. If you fall, it's not any higher outside than it is inside.
Hey, hold it.
Yeah, this is the level we want.
We're lucky the window isn't locked.
Well, what's in there, Dan?
The property room.
Hey, this is directly below Al Granby's dressing room, isn't it?
And that's what gave me the idea. Now then, when I open the window, everybody climb in.
Shh, be absolutely quiet.
Oh, gee, it's dark.
How about my flashlight? No, can't take a chance.
Well, what are we looking for?
We're not looking for, we're waiting for.
Well, who are we waiting for?
I don't know for sure, but I have a hunch. Hey, close that window. I don't want whoever comes in to suspect anything. Now, that's good. Now, Dave, have your flashlight handy, but don't turn it on until I give the word.
Yeah, all set, Dan.
Okay, fellas, now be quiet and get behind that big packing case. No, not that one. This one. Now then, that door over there leads to backstage. It won't be long before someone comes through that door, and whoever it is, it'll be our murderer.
Shh. Someone's coming.
Okay, you. Hold it. Turn that flashlight on, Dave.
Don't shoot. It's me, Pop.
Yeah, we know it's you, Pop. We can see sharp and clear. Here, get your hands behind your back.
You have to do that.
I'm afraid so. After what you've done, I don't want you to get your hands on me.
How'd you know, Lieutenant?
A stagehand told me you used to perform in musical comedy. He said that sometimes, when you were singing as you worked around here, Tom Kent, whose voice was young and still in good form, made fun of you.
Well, he didn't have to needle me about sounding like a fraud or an old crow. He never sang opposite Fritzy Chef or Blanche Ray or... I couldn't take it any longer. I had to wipe that sneer off his face.
You better not talk until you get a lawyer, Pop.
I know all that stuff about my rights. I don't want a lawyer. And I killed Al Granby, too.
Hey,
what?
Dave. Because he saw you kill Tom Kent, right?
Right. He was a witness. I had to kill him.
Yeah, that's why he couldn't have slugged you backstage. He was already dead. And you were the only one with a key to the master light switch box. You switched off the house lights and faked being slugged.
Yeah, but why did you blacken Kent's face? Why that afro wig? And why wrap him in Granby's dressing?
Yeah, it was stupid, I guess, but I figured it would confuse the police long enough for me to take care of Al and get out of town. It was all for nothing, wasn't it, Lieutenant?
I'm afraid it was, Pop. And if you'd been thinking straight, you should have known that at your age you couldn't have carried off a packing case with a man's body in it.
Was that what I'm trying to drag out of the prop room? He'd never have made it.
Haven't you noticed? He didn't make it.
So there it is. She's missing all these great pictures. She needs everything.
That's amazing. Listen, I think I have exactly what you're looking for. It's a brand new thing. It's a Kodak Pocket Smile Saver Kit.
Look at that, will you?
It has a Kodak Pocket Instamatic 10 camera and a neat carrying
case. And film and
magic cubes. And
well, that's everything she needs.
Exactly.
Well, listen, I can't spend a lot of money on
this.
It's only a hobby.
This is perfect. This is less than
$30. Oh, that's terrific. It's a complete outfit? I can't believe it.
How are you going to get this to her?
I'm going up on the roof. Like I get her everything. I'll just hand it to her as she goes by.
She goes
every
by?
90 minutes.
Every 90
yeah,
minutes.
At an altitude of 38 feet.
That's
yeah.
really
well,
low.
Well, that liftoff was a little off. It's a good orbit. I don't know where she goes.
Tell me how she got started as an amateur astronaut.
Boy, I wish I knew. She was rewiring a house.
Now available for a limited time only. The Kodak Pocket Smile Saver Kit for less than $30. 6 6 a smile go a long, long way.
Oh, I can't wait to see the pictures she takes with it.
Splashdown is...
Thursday in the pool.
I'm Rod Serling. Close your eyes. Exercise your imagination. And join us again on our next presentation of The Zero Hour.
Death is the Puppeteer is a radio drama adapted by Glenn Hall Taylor. Lyle Wagner was heard as Dan McBride. Featured in the cast were Jim Bowles, Grace Leonard, Tony O'Dare, Jerry Dexter, and Herb Biker. Zero Hour, created by J.M. Coolis, directed by Don Hills, is produced in Hollywood for the Mutual Broadcasting System by Radio Productions, Incorporated. Music is composed and conducted by Stanley D. Hoffman. Rochelle Sherman, associate producer. This has been a presentation of the Mutual Broadcasting System.
That's the Relic Radio Show for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. You can find past episodes of this show and more old-time radio at relicradio.com. You'll also find links there to our Facebook page, forum, Shoutcast stream, everything else Relic Radio. There's also a support Relic Radio button if you'd like to donate to the cause. I appreciate anything you're able to help out with. And thank you, as always, to those who have. Thanks for joining me today. I'll be back next Tuesday with a brand new episode of the Relic Radio Show.